Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present once again Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International, published in softcover by Autano Media, copyright 1999. Kevin, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
In your book, you talk about elements of what you describe as the post-war fascist international, and there are a number of people and institutions in this post-war fascist international that I'd like to discuss, and if you could relate these to Francis Parker Yockey, fine, but otherwise, let's just discuss the elements themselves. First of all, Johann von Leers, who was he, and what is Der Weg?
Well, Johann von Leers was born in 1902, and he became, in the early 30s, a big propagandist for the Nazi Party. He worked very closely with Goebbels and was actually a member of the propaganda ministry. He was probably best known in the 30s for writing these really crazy, hysterical rants against the Jews. And he wrote them from a kind of a weird standpoint of a paganism. Leers considered himself a pagan and was involved with the Nordic faith movement. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. Where he comes into my book is that after the war, he went to Argentina, to Buenos Aires, and became the editor of a publication called Der Weg, which means the way or the path. And Der Weg was one of the hard-line Nazi publications in exile. And what happened is that Yockey began writing for Der Weg, and Der Weg began reprinting a lot of both material from Yockey and the European Liberation Front. So that's really how I first encountered von Leers.
Fill us in real briefly, Kevin, on the European Liberation Front. We touched on that in our last interview.
Well, the European Liberation Front was Yockey's propaganda organization that he set up in 1948, which distributed his writings, including a pamphlet called The Proclamation of London, which was their sort of theoretical document. Basically, it was Yockey's propaganda group, although they did have members and meetings in primarily in England, where it was most organized.
And I'd like to read a quote, Kevin, about Johann von Leers and have you develop his philosophy a little more in a little more detail for us. On page 276, you write of von Leers, "Von Leers' turn to the East was intertwined with an intense belief in the occult. A pagan sun worshiper, he contributed an article for Der Weg's 10th anniversary issue called The New World Age, unquote, in which he predicted, quoting, "It will soon be impossible for people performing miracles with hypnotism, spiritual healing, telepathy, and occultism to be fobbed off with the tribal god Jehovah and to force their new piety into old bottles," unquote. It might seem odd for the uninitiated, and that's not meant to be patronizing, to see this sort of thinking and this sort of outlook in a Goebbels propaganda ministry official. I wonder if you develop some of that background for us further.
Sure. Basically, the best way to see Leers is that he was part of the far right of the German New Age movement of the 1920s. The German New Age movement was in revolt against Christianity, primarily, and against Judaism, and they saw Christianity as kind of an outgrowth of Judaism. So their hatred of the Jews, their own, paranoia against the Jews, was also directed against Christianity, against the Catholic Church. So Leers, in his writings, not just went after the Jews, but also the Catholic Church and denounced various bishops, et cetera, et cetera. All during the 1930s, within the Nazi Party, there was a very strong element that was actually against religion and the Catholic Church in particular. Leers basically began in the 20s with a group called the Onan Erba, which sort of, the Onan Erba is kind of a little bit difficult to explain, but it was really a think tank that had been set up around a man named Hermann Wirth, who
Kevin, that's W-I-R-T-H.
Yeah, Wirth, actually, right. Hermann Wirth, who wrote a book in 1928 called The Origins of Mankind, and he had developed this idea that mankind really came from the north, the far north, the sort of polar ice caps, and that this is that humanity was basically Aryan in origin. And people like Leers, who made a very strong point of being irrationalist and pagan and sort of rooted in the soil, etc., basically embraced this view. What happened is that unfortunately, so did Heinrich Himmler. And so by the mid-1930s, the Onan Erba became actually incorporated into the SS, and Himmler tremendously financed the Annenerbe's research, which existed until the end of Germany in 1945.
Kevin, in Dreamer of the Day, you also talk about a fellow, and I'd like you to touch on this briefly for us, a fellow named Walter de Ray and the, quote, green, unquote, element of the German Nazi Party. There's a book that I've touched on in past discussion called Ecofascism, and one of the points that I made in that discussion was that there are elements of the green or pro-environment philosophy that overlap Nazism and the NSDAP. I do not want to be misunderstood as equating the two in any way, any more than when I talk about certain types of alternative subcultures, whether philosophical or literary or music, that all or even most of them are fascist. But often in some of the discussions that I engage in on air, I touch on some of these subcultures, and then people get bent out of shape because they think I'm talking about either
everybody,
the New Age or the black metal music scene or something else as being fascist. I don't want to be misunderstood in that regard, but you talked about de Ray and the green element of the Nazi Party. Develop that for us.
Well, de Ray became, in Germany under Hitler, the Minister of Agriculture, and de Ray had a very strong peasant orientation. In other words, he was very opposed to large industry. He sort of romanticized the medieval world. He very much believed that Germany's downfall came with Charlemagne, because Charlemagne essentially introduced Christianity to the Germans when the Romans had failed. When the Romans failed to conquer Germany, the Germans remained pagan. But when Charlemagne essentially dominated Germany in the 800s, the Germany converted to Christianity. So he had a very romantic, mystical, soil-centered outlook, which was anti-technological. I would say that rather than equate him with the phrase he's part of the Green Party or the Green Wing of the Nazi Party is a little bit misleading, because we kind of think of the Greens in the context of the 1970s and Earth Day. Really, he's an expression of this long-standing tradition in Germany of this kind of back-to-the-nature Volkism, which under the influence of the Nazis took on this kind of rabid anti-Semitic dimension. One other important point about him, however, for my book's sake, is that he tended to be in opposition to Himmler, because de Ray was so rooted in the peasantry that he disliked the idea of Germany expanding into non-German territories, primarily Russia. Although even here you've got to be careful about this, because, you know, when the Germans invaded Russia, I mean, de Ray was on the picket line saying, you know, turn around. I mean, de Ray was you know, all for it. But he definitely did have some ideological differences with Himmler. And these differences were reflected in the Annenerbe itself, because there had been a fight inside the Annenerbe where Wirt, who had been very close to de Ray, was actually kicked out in the late 1930s, and a Himmler protege was put in charge of the Annenerbe. So there are distinctions to be made, but one shouldn't get carried away with those distinctions. That's the way I would see it.
Some of the figures very prominently in some of the discussion of your book is a fellow named Julius Evola. If you could tell us, give us a synopsis of his history, and then I'd like to get into some of his not only institutional connections, such as Iron Guard, SD, Ordine Nuovo, but then, and this will be a tall order, to discuss some of his philosophy and how it impinges on some of his political activities and those around him. But first of all, if you could give us a synopsis of Evola's political resume, if you would.
Well, he was born in the late 1800s, and he was primarily a poet and an artist up until the end of World War One. Then he turned to the East in mysticism. I should say right off that he's an Italian, born in Rome. He fought with the Italians in the Italian army in World War One. Came back to Italy and became very much interested in the appeal of a pagan mythology and almost all other kinds of mythology. So he began investigating these topics and writing about them. And again, at a very early point, he had problems with the Catholic Church, because he, from a very early period, believed that that Catholicism was really a kind of a shoddy, cowardly religion, and that the true identity of Rome should be with the Roman Empire and with the sort of the spirit of the Indo-Europeans. So by the mid-20s, he began writing attacks on the Catholic Church and glorifying really the Indo-European world, in other words, the pre-Christian world. And he looked particularly to India for his model. And the thing that he most liked is he liked there was, in India, India is divided in the Hindu worldview into different castes. And the we all have kind of heard of the Brahmins, who are basically the sort of priestly caste. But there was another caste, which was really the warrior caste, called the Kshatriya. And Avila's idea was that the problem with Europe is that the Brahmin caste had sort of had too much power. The Brahmin caste in Europe being represented by the Catholics, by the Catholic Church, by the Vatican, and that really the warrior caste should be the should really call the tune. And of course, he identified himself with the warrior caste.
Kevin, let me interrupt briefly. If you would spell Kshatriya for us, just for the benefit of people who have not heard the word.
Well, that's a good question, and I'd have to look it up.
I think it's Kshatriya, but I'm operating from memory.
I'll buy that.
Yeah, it's certainly close enough for jazz, as they say.
Hey, you didn't tell me there would be a spelling test.
Well, that's okay. This is a surprise quiz. We'll see how it goes, and we'll see if you measure up to the.
I'm doomed.
To the Bhagavad Gita, or to the Vedic standards of the surprise quiz here. So anyway,
next is algebra.
Yeah. What we're gonna. Avila had a complex philosophy, and even in the. 17 or 18 minutes we've got left, we certainly could not get into it in too much detail. Avila had a sort of occult worship of, or advocacy of, or maybe both, of violence that went beyond mere political violence, although I'd like to talk about that in a minute. But if you could explain how that dovetails with his occult philosophy and perhaps also the Kshatriya caste and how he saw it.
Well, probably the best way to look at this would be to see him in the, first in a more general political context. He strongly identified in the 1920s, not so much with the Nazis, but with people in Germany called the conservative revolutionaries, and primarily with a German philosopher of history called Oswald Spengler. And in fact, Avila translated part of Spengler's book, The Decline of the West, into Italian. Now, Spengler had this idea, which very much appealed to Avila, which was the idea that civilization rises and inevitably collapses. And this appealed to Avila because he could find echoes of this in Hindu ideas of the final age, the dark age, what's called the Kali Yuga. And so he saw Spengler as kind of giving a map to the Kali Yuga in the West, and that was the idea that Western civilization had basically exhausted itself and was in the process of inevitable decline. And for Spengler, the people who would take over from the West were, as Spengler put it, the colored world, by which he just didn't mean the Asians and, you know, black people, but he also meant the Russians, because he also felt that the Russians were part of this kind of barbaric world. Now, the question for Spengler and also for Avila was, well, how do we resist this this takeover of the West? In other words, they both thought it was inevitable, but they both believed that it could be resisted. But in order for it to be resisted to the most, you had to have in the leadership of the West not the politicians and not the nice guys, but really a kind of an order of sort of warriors who would sort of put the West on a military footing and try and keep the barbarians at bay. And this led Avila in particular to sort of fetishize this warrior caste. And so in the 1930s, when the SS, Himmler's SS arose, actually it arose earlier in the 20s, but when the Germans took power with the SS and the SS became important in the early 1930s, Avila, although he was not a Nazi and did not believe in the Volkist viewpoint of the world, of course, because he was Italian. You know, he wasn't German. He didn't have Germanic blood.
Let me interrupt, Kevin. By Volkist viewpoint of the world, explain that briefly for people not familiar with it.
It means the idea that Germans have this kind of pure blood, and the German race, because it is pure of descent, deserves really to kind of rule the rest of the world.
And this is a Nordic outlook. So
yes,
right.
Extremely Nordic outlook.
Okay.
But also based on kind of pseudobiology. And a lot of this pseudobiology was later pumped out through groups like the Annenerbe. But getting back to Avila, what he that kind of racial aspect is really what he didn't like, but what he did like was the idea of a kind of a very powerful order controlling the policy of Germany, which he saw with the SS. And he took as other examples of this in Western history, the most famous, I guess, would be the Knights Templar, which was basically a group of medieval knights that set up a kind of an international order in the around the time of the Crusades, and had their own banking and financial group and their own military group. So and they arose really to fight against the Muslims. So the idea that he had was that we needed this kind of order type formation to fight against the decline. And where violence comes in, where he makes such a big deal about violence, is that the violence was a way of sort of, violence became an initiation almost, that the people who would be most involved in the leadership of the order were also people who would use violence to get their way, not just for political means, but because violence itself had some kind of deeper meaning, that violence was almost a kind of initiation rite into this greater world. So he completely romanticized the warrior.
And this also, though, in addition to being an occult or metaphysical outlook, also translated directly into hands-on political action in institutions.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, one of the things that's most interesting about him is that he, in the 1930s, first he became tied in with one of the most violent groups in Europe, a group called the Iron Guard in Romania.
Tell us about the Iron Guard.
Well, the Iron Guard was a group that emerged in the mid-1930s in Romania as a really a radical right-wing populist party. And they fought for power, and one of the ways they fought for power is they organized what they called, which were assassination squads. They were organized in what they called cells. And so the Iron Guard is probably best known for its ideology, one slogan in particular, which was the slogan, quote, long live death. And again, this gets back to violence, because what they were really meaning was that one should be willing to, that death, that the warrior's death, was almost a kind of like a holy sacrifice. So if you not just killed people, but were killed in turn, you almost went to the sort of Iron Guard heaven, in a certain sense. You became a kind of like a living saint and a living martyr. So this group, because it had such an extremely violent approach to politics, actually, it was repressed in Romania in the late 1930s. The leader of Romania, the king of Romania, actually cracked down on them and ordered the arrest and execution of their leader. Avila was very much involved with the Iron Guard, which itself had been getting some support from various elements of fascist Italy. But the major supporter of the Iron Guard was actually Germany, and the Germans were very much interested in the Iron Guard, and the Germans who were most involved with the Iron Guard were tied in with a group called the SD. The SD was the security service, kind of like the CIA, of the SS.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it was a branch of the SS, which was their foreign intelligence branch. And one reason why the SD was so hot to trot with the Iron Guard is because Romania had a great deal of oil. And they felt that if the Iron Guard could make a coup in Romania, which the Iron Guard tried to do more than once, that Germany would basically benefit from the oil.
A couple of interjections. SD, by the way, stands for Sicherheitsdienst, the security force. And people familiar with the history of World War II may be familiar with the very costly to the Allies Ploesti raids on the Romanian oil field.
Yes.
Because of the strategic importance that you've just spoken about. Go ahead, Kevin.
I should also point out that ironically, the SS backing of the Iron Guard sort of alienated Hitler, because Hitler himself was sort of backing a kind of a coalition government in Romania. And when the Iron Guard launched this SS-backed coup, Hitler was actually kind of furious with the SS for doing that. And this is described in Walter Schellenberg's memoirs. Schellenberg was one of the heads of foreign intelligence of the SS. But anyway, Avila, in the late 1930s, was very much involved with the Iron Guard, had gone to Romania, had met the leader of the Iron Guard, and wrote a lot of propaganda for the Iron Guard in Italian publications. Then later in the 1950s, when Avila was back in Rome and sort of spreading his propaganda in the Italian radical right-wing youth, two models he looked to, one was the SS, and the other, even more so, was the Iron Guard, because the Iron Guard itself was set up kind of like an order. So this idea of glorification of the most violent type groups as models for the Italian post-war right really came partly from Evola's own sort of obsession and fascination with the Romanian Iron Guard.
If you would develop a little further for us along those same lines, Kevin, the Ordine Nuovo, or New Order in English, and the strategy of tension and Evola's influence on them.
Well, the New Order was a group that had been very, very influenced by Evola's thinking. The New Order was really represented the far right of the Italian post-war fascist organization, the MSI. The MSI, the Italian Social Movement, was a group that really represented the supporters of Mussolini, who, after the war, formed a legal political party, you have to say. What happened is that a lot of the hardliners, however, especially among the sort of young radicals, young fascist radicals, didn't like the fact that the MSI was involved with the Italian parliament. So what they wanted is they wanted a kind of a confrontational street fighter force. So they broke with the MSI in the mid-1950s, and their leader was very much oriented towards Evola's writings. The leader was a guy named, if my memory is correct, Rauti, Pino Rauti, and he was a devotee of Evola and knew the guy. So what happened is that groups like the New Order very much embraced this idea of violence and we're the members of the warrior caste, etc. And because they felt like this, they were very useful to the Italian Secret Service and the Italian police forces in confronting the left and having sort of street fights and breaking up leftist demonstrations. Because with that group, you got advanced in that group, not just because you were, quote, anti-communist, but because also by embracing this kind of violence and bombings and beatings, etc., you showed that you had the true warrior spirit.
Tell us briefly about Prince Borghese, and he actually wrote an introduction to Men in the Ruins, didn't he?
Yes. Prince Borghese was a kind of a pop star for the Italian far right in the 1940s. The reason why he was so popular is that during the war, he had developed what were called actually midget submarines, and the Italian Navy used them very successfully against the British, and Borghese was sort of the... Borghese was an Italian naval commander, and his group, which was called Decima Mas, was one wing of the Italian Navy. He was kind of the Otto Skorzeny of the waves, if you want to put it that way. I mean, he was the Italian equivalent of Skorzeny.
Mm-hmm.
After Mussolini fell from power, he took his naval troops and actually made them a fighting force in northern Italy under the direction of a man named General Wolfe, who was the sort of the a big... fellow in the SS.
General Karl Wolf.
Yeah, Karl Wolf, who had been appointed the major commander of all German forces in the north after Mussolini's downfall. So he had very strong connections, to put it mildly, with the with the German government and the German military. He was then arrested and put in jail very briefly, actually, only for a couple of years, for war crimes. One of the reasons why he survived, Mussolini was executed by the partisans, but Borghese wasn't. And one reason was because James Angleton, later of CIA fame, the head of CIA counterintelligence, during 1945 was very much involved in Italian politics with the OSS. And Angleton personally got Borghese out of the north of Italy, smuggled him back to Rome to interrogate him, and I think, and other people think as well, to try and win him over to the American side. And so, just like in Germany, where there was strong opposition to the Nuremberg trials, not just among the Germans, but also among certain people in the American military who felt that we needed these guys to fight the commies, Borghese was seen also like in a similar way, that we get Borghese out of jail, he'll rally the far right, to oppose the communist threat, which in Italy was a real threat because the Communist Party was extremely powerful. It's really the most successful Communist Party in all of Western Europe. So when Borghese, later in 1952, writes the introduction to a book by Evola called Men from Under the Ruins, what I think that you're seeing is a kind of a convergence of the sort of more Atlanticist, kind of pro-Western alliance elements willing to work with these extreme rightists, basically in a popular front against the communists.
Speaking of Atlanticists, this brings up a division within some elements of the post-war fascist international, as you put it. We've only got a little over 3 minutes left, Kevin, so we're going to have to telescope a lot.
Sure.
The polarities that Abelus saw in his occult philosophy, and Francis Parker Yockey was of a similar influence, led to not only one couldn't call it pro-Soviet, but certainly a favoring of Russia or the Soviets over the United States, and a virulent anti-Americanism. And I wonder if you could relate Abelard's occultism and also the polarities concept of Yockey to the virulent anti-American or anti-Atlanticist fascist outlook.
Well, basically, what I say in the book, and this is a very complicated subject, but for Abelard also really disliked very much the United States. But because Italy had the reality that the Italian Communist Party was extremely strong in Italy and did appoint, threatened to enter the government, people like Evola tended to make a sort of, from their point of view, a devil's alliance with the Americans to prevent the Italian Communists from ever threatening to take power. And this relates later into something called Operation Gladio, which was this attempt by the CIA to finance a lot of right-wing figures to prevent the Italian communists from taking power. That said, in general, the people like Evola and Yockey as well had a very strong contempt for not just the United States, but the United States as the representative of what they saw as a kind of Enlightenment-type thinking. They saw the United States as representing this force which was changing the old culture of Europe. And so they equated everything which we would think of as kind of liberalism, you know, equality for women, ending discrimination, you know, et cetera, all these things as somehow corrupting the pure soul of Europe. And from that standpoint, even though Russia represented a threat to them, America was a more dangerous threat because America was sort of infecting Europe with its cultural values. And out of this came a very strong tendency to view America as the ultimate kind of cultural killer of old Europe, and to think that Russia, well, you know, Russia has problems, but really the main threat is from the United States, not so much from Russia, that Russia could be handled. Now, I have to say that this argument, well, it was an argument in the far right, and many people in the far right did not believe this. Many people in the far right believed that Russia was the primary enemy, and that although America had problems, it was better to work with America than against Russia than to have any sympathy with Russia against America. And in my book, I show how this argument worked out between, for example, Yockey on the one hand and Oswald Mosley on the other, where Mosley was more inclined to go with the Americans, and Yockey was much more of a what they call a third-position neutralist, willing to sort of cozy up to the Russians, you know, on certain points. And one point in particular was the fact that under Stalin in the early 1950s, Stalin began this anti-Jewish campaign, which he called the, quote, anti-cosmopolitan campaign. So there was this idea that within Russia they had certain kinds of sympathy, that the Russians had certain sympathies for the, you know, that were anti-Semitic.
Okay. Kevin, we are all out of time, so what I'm going to do is to tell people how to get Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International, published in softcover by Otano Media, copyright 1999. Otano Media can be reached at Post Office Box 568, Williamsburg Station, Brooklyn, New York, 11211-0568, USA. Phone and fax 718-963-2603. And their website is www.otanomedia.org, and your book was edited by Dave Mandel of WFMU in New Jersey. This concludes For the Record program number 221. For Kevin Coogan, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.